We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer is Harriet Williamson. I'm Arthur Deal. Jason Croft is at the controls. We have made a small change in our schedule for this morning. We, on another day, will be doing the conversation we had planned, focusing on media, race, and policing in the U.S. with Robert Lombardo from Loyola University. Instead, we'll go to the Focus 580 archives for a program we first broadcast in June, a conversation with former head of the U.S. FDA, David Kessler. We talked about his recent book, The End of Overeating. As you listen, do keep in mind that in this hour, we'll not be taking calls. For most of human history, body weight stayed remarkably stable. However, in the 1980s, things changed. At that point, researchers noted a spike in the number of people who were overweight. And today, we know that weight and diseases associated with weight, like heart disease and diabetes, these things are top public health issues. In this hour of the show, we'll try to talk a little bit about why it is, for many people, it is so difficult to resist certain foods and why it is so easy to overindulge, and the role that all of that plays in the nation's weight problems. And our guest for the program is Dr. David Kessler. He served as the commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration under Presidents George H.W. Bush and also Bill Clinton. He's a pediatrician. He's been the dean of the medical schools at Yale and University of California, San Francisco, and he is the author of a newly published book that we'll be talking about. The book is titled The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. Rodale is the publisher on the book. And in the book, he essentially makes the argument that foods we really like, things that are high in fat and salt and sugar, actually alter the chemistry of the brain in ways that compel people to overeat. It is something he argues that the food industry understands pretty well and uses it to get people sometimes to eat more than they should. Dr. Kessler, hello.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and yourself?
I'm well, thank you for having me.
Good. You know, yesterday I was looking at a talk that you gave about this subject matter, and I think that it was something that occurred just very shortly before the book was published. And one of the things you did at the beginning was you showed a slide that was the cover of the book. And I have it here in front of me, and we have here at the top of the page a photograph of a big chunk of carrot cake. And then there's the title of the book, The End of Overeating. And then at the bottom of the page, there's a photograph of some carrots. And you said, looking at this cover, you said, this is the book right there. Here's the point of the whole thing. So when you look at that, you look at the carrot cake and the carrots, what is it that you see?
You know, I think that's the way you put it is exactly right. What captures your attention? Hmm. I mean, when you look at that, David, right?
Yeah.
That cover right in front of you. Where does your eye go toward?
It goes to the carrot cake.
Why?
Well, I guess my first thing is to say, it's at the top, but I think that's not quite right. Something about it is just more. You can look at that picture of the carrot cake, and you can start to taste the carrot cake.
It's based on learning, based on past experience. Right? Your attention has been captured by that image, and not the carrot. The jacket designer Chip Kidd, designed that graphic, and it took me a little while to understand. He captured the whole concept of salience. Mm. What is salience? Right? We're all wired to focus on the most salient stimuli in our environment. What do I mean by that? You know, if our kid is sick this morning, we're thinking about our kids. If a bear walked into the studio right now, you'd stop interviewing me and you'd focus on the bear. You look at that cover of that jacket, and what's the most salient stimuli? It's the carrot cake. It's not the carrot. And that's based on past experience. But you see how your attention is grabbed, right? And that's just not your attention. That's based on your brain circuitry. So we're wired to focus on the most salient stimuli. For some people, it might be alcohol, it could be gambling, it could be sex, it could be tobacco, but for many of us, it's food. And within food, what is the most salient stimuli? At its core, fat, sugar, and salt.
Hmm. How much of this does indeed have to do with the fact that it seems that we are wired, and there might have been a good reason for being wired that way, but for we were being wired to find those things really satisfying and really attractive. And if you put it in front of us, it's going to be, for a lot of people, it's going to be very difficult not to eat that thing.
You know, is it really what's satisfying or is it what's stimulating?
Hmm.
And now, you know, that was a question that I didn't, you know, didn't fully understand the answer to. Let me step back for a moment and tell you the journey for the last 7 years. You know, what I wanted to understand was why it's so hard for so many of us to resist eating. I was watching Oprah one night, and there was a woman on it, very well-educated, very smart, very sophisticated, very intelligent, and she said, I eat when my husband leaves for work in the morning. I eat before he comes home at night. I eat when I'm happy. I eat when I'm sad. I eat when I'm hungry. I eat when I'm not hungry, and I don't like myself. And I was able to relate to that because, you know, I have suits in every size. And I wanted to understand. I want to be able to explain to that woman. I wanted to be able to listen as a physician, as a clinician. Why was this woman very successful, doing things that she knew she didn't want to be doing, right, but doing it anyway? I mean, if diet and exercise worked, we would all do it. But why is it so hard? And that's really the journey for the last 7 years. And we now have the science, right, to know, to be able to explain to that woman, it's not her fault. I mean, it's the fact is her brain is being excessively activated by the food and the food cues, I mean, that are ubiquitous in the environment.
It seems that they hear that there's an important point, and I know you made it when you talk about this, you just made it, and that is, and I think that this is something that is common too often to our reaction when we have people who have addiction issues, and no matter what that is, could be sex, it could be alcohol, could be food, could be a lot of other things, that we somehow react as if this was a personal moral failing of that individual, that it was a matter of personal weakness. And so often the response to them is said, well, you know, come on, get a hold of yourself, pull yourself together, as if that was something that they could do. And what that does is really ignore the fact that there's something else going on here, something that's going on in their brains. And it's not just a matter of willpower, and it's not really their fault.
Exactly. You said it very eloquently. But let me give you the science.
Yeah.
Right? Let me give you the pieces of the puzzle, right? And then let's put it together and come back to your point. And I promise you I won't lose the audience on the science. Let's just start with what drives consumption, right? The vanilla milkshake. What is it about the vanilla milkshake that drives consumption? We published a paper, not a typical scientific title of a paper. It's called Deconstructing the Vanilla Milkshake. You think it's the sugar? You think it's the fat? You think it's the flavor? What's the prime driver?
Well, I guess that would be my thought. It would be something about all those things. We have them one time, and we say, boy, that's really great, and so you want to have that again, and maybe the next time you want to have it even more.
Right, but the prime driver. The prime driver, interestingly, is sugar.
Ah,
but when you add fat to it, it's synergistic. In fact, you know, I worked with my colleagues in Italy, Gaetano Di Ceri, one of the great pharmacologists. What Gaetano has studied over his life is he studied drugs, and he's, you know, amphetamine, cocaine, and he's given those drugs, and he's, you know, been able to administer those drugs and measure the dopamine response. Dopamine is the chemical, the part of the circuitry of the brain that captures your attention, that locks in your focus, right? And, what you know, it's always thought that amphetamine, cocaine, elevated dopamine, and not only the first time you gave those drugs, but repeatedly, right? But food, you maybe get a little dopamine bump the first time, but it, you know, second time, third time, you know, you didn't get that rise. You habituated, as scientists say. But food was different than drugs. But what we found, when we gave the animals food that was multisensory, not just sugar, but sugar and fat, right, what we found is that there was increased activation of the dopamine circuits. Then we did one other thing. I wanted to understand this woman. This woman on Oprah who had said, I eat when I'm hungry, I eat when I'm not hungry. How many people were like that, and what really was the basis of that what she was describing. It's not a disease, right? But that syndrome, that syndrome that's sort of conditioned and driven. Let me give you three characteristics. Some people, when I raise these characteristics, have no idea what I'm talking about. Right? They, they can't relate. Others, when I raise these, say, you're describing me. So let me give you the three characteristics. Hard time resisting your favorite food. A loss of control in the face of highly palatable foods. Two, a lack of feeling full, a lack of satiation when you're eating. Three, a preoccupation of thinking about food, sometimes between meals, but sometimes even when you're eating, you're thinking about what you're going to eat next. So those three characteristics, loss of control, lack of satiation, preoccupation with foods. And what we found was about 50% of obese individuals, about 30% of overweight individuals, about 20% of healthy weight individuals scored very high on all three characteristics. And that may not sound like a lot, but when you extrapolate, to the general population, and there's risks of extrapolation, that's some 70 million people who score very high in that loss of control, lack of satiation, preoccupation, and understand that's a continuum. There are a lot of people who have some of those characteristics. Now, a small percentage of the population, when I say those characteristics, I mean, they have, they would tell you, food doesn't interest me very much. I mean, to them, they take a pill rather than eat. Now, they're the ones we probably should study. They're probably the ones most scientifically, interesting. But what we did is we took the people who scored very high on those three characteristics, that conditioned and conditioned hypereating, we call it, and we scanned their brains. And we scanned their brains during two phases. The first phase is just when they're anticipating food. The power of food comes not just from its taste, but from the anticipation of it, just thinking about it. I was walking down Powell Street, and I started thinking about chocolate-covered pretzels. Why? Because I had been on that street 6 months earlier. I'd forgotten all about it. I was in a store. I bought those chocolate-covered pretzels. Sometimes it's location. Sometimes it's a sight. It can be the smell. Just getting in your car can trigger thoughts of wanting because you've been in the car. You've driven somewhere. And then the car becomes the cue, right? So if you just give people the smell of food and these people who have this conditioned hypereating, and again, it's millions of us in all likelihood, you see activation of the brain's reward circuits on the neural imaging, on the brain scanning. The amygdala lights up. But what's most fascinating is when they start eating the food, those reward pathways still remain activated compared to people who don't have this, and they don't shut off until the food's all gone. So we now know we have a biological correlate of this behavior, and as you just said very eloquently, it's not a matter of willpower. It's not because they're lazy or can't control it. Their brains are being literally activated, hijacked by all the food cues around them.
And that the reason that it gets more and more difficult not to have that activation is that the cues and maybe also the opportunities to eat are everywhere. They're all around us, and we now have come to a point where we've gotten away from the idea that three squares a day is what you have, and you eat at certain times and you don't eat at other times. We have the opportunity to eat all the time, and so a lot of people do eat all the time.
The business plan of the modern American food company has been to take fat, sugar, and salt, put it on every corner, make it available 24/7, make it socially acceptable to eat, to make food into entertainment, walk into a food court in the mall, right? And it's like a food carnival. I see this cartoon, the names of the different food establishments, in these food malls. Mm-hmm. I look at that and I see, what I see now is changing the names on the signs. One really should be called fat and salt. One should be called fat and sugar. One should be called fat, sugar, and salt.
Our guest, let me just very quickly introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Dr. David Kessler. He served as commissioner of the U.S. FDA under Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. He's a pediatrician by his academic training. He's been dean of the med schools at Yale and University of California, San Francisco, and is author of the book The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite, stimulated, I think, in part, maybe at least in small part, by his personal experience, but also by his observation that there seemed to be a lot of people who could not control their eating, and were really unhappy about it. And the question he was trying to get at was, well, what's happening here? And what could possibly be done to change the way those people's brains have become trained and the way that they work? And is it possible to get people to think differently about food? Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Another important point I think you make is that this kind of association, this way of thinking about food, this effect that food has on so many people, it's something that gets established early in life, certainly before adulthood.
You're exactly right. Let me just review how this works. Based on past learning, past memory, we get cue, the sight, the smell, the time of day, the location. That cue activates our brain. It causes arousal. It causes our attention to get focused. We consume the product. We have that momentary pleasure. It's always ephemeral, right? I mean, that dissipates. We get cued again. Every time we respond to that cue and engage in the behavior again and again, we strengthen the neural circuits. And the behavior becomes conditioned, and this is key. Right? Remember Pavlov?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Certainly the behavior becomes conditioned, but it's not only conditioned behavior, it's conditioned and driven behavior. So it involves not only the learning circuits, it's the learning and motivational circuits of the brain. Because what happens once your brain is activated and you try to stop it? I mean, you know, that inner dialogue, boy, that looks good. No, I shouldn't have it. Yes, I want that. Nah, not this time. I mean, when you start having that inner dialogue, that's the stuff of obsessions, of cravings. So the behavior becomes conditioned and driven. Now, you ask me, when does it start? Let me tell you what we know. Toddlers, children the age of 2, compensate for their eating. What do I mean by that? If you give them more calories at lunch, they'll eat fewer calories later in the day. If you expose these kids to fat, sugar, and salt all the time, the ages 2, 3, 4, 5, by the time they're 5 years old, they lose the ability to compensate. It's as if the reward pathways of the brain override the body's homeostatic mechanisms.
Let's take some calls. We've got a number of folks here who'd like to talk with you. We'll start in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Kessler. Hi, David.
Hi.
I'm Dr. Kessler. It's so funny. I just turned on the radio and heard you because all week we've been talking about your book. Oh, shh. My toddlers who just really are obsessed with McDonald's. Santi, I'm on the phone. Anyway, I have I'm in a weight loss class, and it's so interesting how some of the other people in the class, without knowing it, are talking exactly about this feeling of I can't drive by Dunkin' Donuts without wanting to go in. And for people who aren't like that, we're like, what do you mean?
Absolutely.
You know, I don't understand it. And so your book has come up and everyone's like, that's it, that's me. And, you know, I'm so tired of feeling like a horrible person who can't control themselves. And so the approach in the weight loss class is very much like an addiction. You know, don't even slip up, you know, not in terms of judgment, but don't go there because it's going to trigger the need for the continued binge, as it were.
You know, it's a fact. That's the reason I wrote the book, was because I, you know, the sense was there were many people out there, and you're right. There's some people when we're talking about this behavior, they have no idea. They can't comprehend it. They don't understand what it's like when the brain gets activated, and you get cued, and that arousal, and that attention gets focused, right? People have never felt good about themselves. They say,
no.
"What's?" Yeah, but there's a reason for this. Now, once we understand that our brains are being activated, you know, then we can put in place the steps to protect ourselves, you know, to fight back and to cool off the stimulus.
Yes, but it's very hard with children, as you heard mine in the background. As you said, the social pressure and the commercials and all that. But it's been just your comments right before I called about the pathways before age 5, it really gives me ammunition to even more, I don't know. It's so easy to go to McDonald's once a week, you know, on a Friday. I don't want to cook again and that kind of thing. And it's kind of, I don't know, I really appreciate your work because it's given me more confidence to say, you know, that's junk food. You're not going to be able to be growing strong and healthy with that. And so now they're kind of getting the message and saying, no, Mom, that's junk food. I don't need that.
See, that's great what you've done. I mean, I just have to applaud because it's so hard. And you walk such a fine line because it's not simple. If it's a question, if the kids think they're being deprived, if they want it, if they think there's something out there that they can't have, right, then they're only going to want it more. The trick is, how do you involve them? How do you educate them? How do they become part of the process so that they learn, right, what do they really want? And if they can learn about nutrition, if they can understand that they don't want to just be stimulated and just eat more and more and more and what's in the food, and they learn those skills for life, then they're going to want, real food, and that's the greatest gift you can give them is to avoid this circuitry from being laid down the first time. Because once the neural circuitry is laid down, it's very hard to undo it. You can add new learning to it, but you never get rid of that old circuitry.
It's so interesting. Well, the last thing I'll say is, again, I appreciate your work because when we've been talking about it and people feeling this way, the analogy to, remember when cigarettes changed from being like everybody smoked to, look, they're trying to trick you into consuming more of this, and they put extra nicotine in there. Well, they're putting extra sugar and salt, and people, you can see the light bulb goes off like, oh, they're playing me? What? And I'm fat?
Right. You've just said it so eloquently, and this is so important. What's the real success with regard to tobacco in this country so far? It was great. I mean, I was there. I mean, on Monday the president signed the bill for the first time giving the ability to regulate tobacco. We haven't had regulation. We haven't had legislation. What's been the real success?
Right.
The success was how we changed how we viewed the product. We used to view the product 30, 40 years ago as, smoking was cool. It was glamorous. It was sexy. It's something I wanted to do. Now, how do we view it? We view it as for what it is, a deadly, disgusting, addictive product. When you have a reinforcing substance and you view it as something you want, as something that's your friend, right, what are you going to do? You're going to approach it. If you have that substance and you view it not as your friend but as something you don't want, what are you going to do? You're going to avoid it. Now, tobacco was easy compared to food. We need food. Food needs to be pleasurable. We can't live without food. We can live without tobacco. So the issue is, how do we perceive foods and which foods? And, increasingly the foods that's loaded and layered with fat, sugar, and salt, that's the foods that we need to be able to perceive in a different way. And, I think the whole movement toward looking at food and saying, hey, is there any real food here? Or is this just designed to stimulate me to eat more?
Yeah.
I mean, but we have to change how people perceive what they're eating because you have to change what they want. If you look at that huge plate of fries and say, that's my friend, I want that. There's nothing I can do that's going to change once the brain is activated. It's so powerful that you're not going to be able to shut that off. Only by, when you look at a cigarette and you say, that's not my friend, that's my enemy.
Right.
I now look at these huge portions of food and I say, that's not my friend. I don't want that.
Well, I really appreciate your work, as I said, and it seems to, at least around here, gone viral. People are always posting things and interviews and articles that you've done on Facebook and things like that. So, again, keep up the good work. I think it's penetrating our brains.
Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for the call. We have some other callers here. Just very quickly, I'll introduce again our guest, Dr. David Kessler, former commissioner of the U.S. FDA. His new book, newly published, is The End of Overeating, subtitled Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite, and it's published by Rodale Press. Let's go on to Marshall. This is the next caller on our we'll go to Champagne first, line number two, then to Marshall. Hello. Line two, go ahead.
Hi. Yes. David, yes, I'd like to ask the doctor, I'll say I agree with the statements about sugar, fat, and salt. In fact, my wife and I, several years ago, went to a seminar at Carl that was put on by an author, and to paraphrase the title of his book, it was, it's not your sweet tooth, it's your fat tooth. And that's what's addicting. You mentioned that the sugar was the leading flavoring or ingredient in a vanilla milkshake. I would go with the fat as opposed to the sugar.
So you're right in part. I mean, the sugar is the main driver. I mean, from the experiments we've done. But when you add fat, it is synergistic. It adds to the power of the food to drive consumption. Let me explain how this works. Okay, and again, the previous caller raised tobacco. So let me give you the analogy. Because it's not any one substance, and this is very important to understand. It's not the sugar or the fat. It's the sugar and fat together. Nicotine. Nicotine is only a moderately reinforcing chemical. But add to that nicotine, the smoke, the throat scratch, the crinkling of the cellophane pack, the color of the pack, the image that was created 30, 40 years of the cowboy, the sexiness, the glamour, the emotional gloss of advertising, the time of day people smoked. And what did we end up? We took a reinforcing product and we made it into a significantly addictive, deadly product. I give you a package of sugar and I say, go have a good time. You look at me and say, what are you talking about? Add to that sugar fat, add temperature, add texture, add color, add mouthfeel, right? Add the emotional gloss of advertising. Put it on every corner. Say you can do it with your friends. Make it into entertainment. You know, go into a food mall. It's a carnival. Right? What do we end up with? You know, we end up with food that is increasingly potent, multisensory, you know, and one of the great public health challenges.
I would just like to add that, if we're going to reform national health insurance, it sure would be great to stop giving tobacco farmers a subsidy payment that should be one savings going towards reform of health care. And for those that are addicted to tobacco, you know, maybe they should pay whoever their health provider is, they should pay a premium because they are using tobacco.
And if you look at food, you know, the issue there, right? I mean, is just look at your point about, you know, we all want, you know, a healthcare system that works better. We all want greater access, greater coverage for people. But if you look at 10 years ago, there were 4 cases of type 2 diabetes per 1,000 people. Today, there are 9 cases per 1,000 people of type 2 diabetes. From 4 cases per 1,000 to 9 cases. What's type 2 diabetes? I could just as well write obesity on the medical chart. We spent in the year 2000 $7 billion for drugs for type 2 diabetes. Today, we spend $13 billion for drugs for type 2 diabetes. So how are we going to afford, you know, the increased coverage and access for people unless we bring this under control? But finally we understand, at least beginning to understand, what's driving this epidemic. And it's not because people are being lazy or not wanting to do the right thing. Literally, the brains of millions of Americans are being hijacked by this fat, sugar, and salt that are being put on every corner.
I want to thank the caller. I'd go to somebody else here, Marshall, next. This is our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Kessler. Thank you. I would like to you to talk a little more specifically about salt. It seems to me of the fat and sugar and salt that salt is the one that doesn't get the recognition in our culture. There's not much pressure, I don't think, on the industries to help us in our culture to get rid of some of this salt in our diet. I'd like to say a few things about my experience with the problem with salt. We've always been nutrition conscious in our family, and we haven't had much trouble with that, following most of the rules, you know, having lots of fruits and vegetables and whole grains all the time, pasta and breads, and low fat and no hydrogenated fat and all that without too much trouble. Then I got Meniere's disease and had to cut back on salt to 1,500 milligrams of sodium a day. And I was under the illusion that just because we didn't add salt at the table, that I didn't have much sodium in my diet. And I think that's what most people think in this culture. But when I started counting the milligrams that I was getting, I was appalled. And I just can't believe how much sodium is in the typical American diet. It's thousands of milligrams, and eating out is just ridiculous. It's almost impossible to eat out. And I discovered in trying to limit my sodium intake in this culture, I just practically couldn't eat out. And I found that I was really pretty addicted to salt. I mean, it made me, the more salt on my food, the more I wanted to eat. when I actually limited the salt, I started to lose weight, and I was able to cut back on my blood pressure medicine. But there's even salt in Jell-O, and it's very hard to shop for the grocery stores. You can't buy anything on most of the aisles. There's too much fat, too much hydrogenated fat, and too much salt in most of the items in the grocery store. Even in Whole Foods, we go all the way to Indianapolis to Whole Foods, you can't get pasta sauce or soups that don't have too much sodium in them. So I will shut up and hang up and listen to your comments, but I'd like to hear you talk about the addictive quality of salt and the health consequences of salt and why there is not more attention being paid to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the call.
I'm so glad the caller just made those points and focused on salt. The fact is that salt does stimulate us to eat more. And it's not just salt, right? I mean, it's just as we talked a little earlier about fat and sugar being synergistic, fat and salt is also synergistic. But, so fat, sugar, and salt, they each stimulate, right? And when you put them together, fat and sugar, fat and salt, fat, sugar, and salt, they get us to eat even more. The caller is exactly right. If we could wean ourselves, and you can change taste over time, we adjust our tastes. The things that, it may not taste well now because we become so conditioned to eat with a certain amount of the tremendous amount of salt, but you can wean that down, and you can do that over time. And there's no question. I used to think that I ate for nutrition, I ate for sustenance, I ate to be satisfying. The fact is, Americans, we're eating for stimulation these days, and salt's a very big part of it.
Well, going back just for a second to this question of how it is you change people's thinking, it's very striking, the parallels here between the issues with food and the issues with tobacco. And you've said, and I think a lot of people would recognize, that one of the things that happened with cigarettes is that we made it unacceptable, socially unacceptable, and we started people think, as you said, we changed from it being something that so many people did, and it was just perfectly acceptable, and you did it everywhere, to something that was disgusting, and we tried to carve out tiny little places where we said only people could smoke there. Well, you can't do that, as you've pointed out. You can't do that with food. You've got to eat. So how do you change the way people think about food?
Well, first of all, you have to understand, if you understand what drives this and the pull, right, then we can start taking the power out of this. David, I mean, let's talk. If I say to you, a hard time resisting certain foods, a lack of satiation, lack of feeling full, thinking about preoccupation with food, does that resonate with you at all?
Actually, people are going to yell and start throwing things at the radio. I would have to say no.
Right.
Actually, I'm one of those people that's in that tiny group that says, food, I could take
it. You're the one I want to study. Because you're not going to get this, right? I mean, we got to get one of your producers to interview me, right? Because it's fascinating. I'm joking. You understand?
Yes.
I'm joking. But it's so fascinating, right? Because you have listeners out there that say, boy, I wish I could be like him. You understand? And he doesn't get this.
Yeah.
Right? And the fact is, once your brain is activated, once you get cued, once that food is in front of you, I mean, whether it's that those warm chocolate chip cookies, that pizza, I mean, it's a little early, but it is in front of you. When you understand how that captures you, for millions of people, food talks, food calls out, and we now understand how that happens. It's because their brains are activated, because they look at that. Right, because of past memory and past experiences, unconsciously the reward pathways get activated, and there's thoughts of wanting. Right? And so, for them, as opposed to you, the question is, how do we cool the stimulus? Right, how do we change it from a hot stimulus to a cool stimulus? So some ways, you can say, well, look, I'm just going to avoid the cues. I'm going to create, a safe environment in my house. I'm going to take the things that are stimulating, and I'm just not going to have them around, so I'm not tempted. Fact is, You know, that may work, and that's a good strategy, but you walk down the street, you get bombarded. For many people, right, the way to deal with constantly having their brain activated is to develop certain private rules. And in some ways, it's anti-intellectual a little, but absolute rules work better, right? When you say, you know, I know if I start to eat fries, I'm going to eat the whole plate. Once they're in front of me, I'm starting to eat. Even though it's only the first couple that are going to taste great, I'm going to eat the whole thing. So for me, it's just better to have this private rule. I'm not going to eat fries. And no ambiguity, right? Because if I go, boy, you know, I like it. I feel deprived. I really want it. No, I'm not going to have it. That kind of private rule is not going to work because it only wants me to – it increases the reward value. Another way that you cool down the stimulus is to eat in a planned way. Why? If I know what I'm going to eat, when I'm going to eat, and what I want to eat, and then, you know, in between that time I get bombarded with cues. If I want something more, right, I mean, I know when I'm going to eat it, then the cues take, you know, the power of the cues decrease in the ability to activate, you know, my brain. If you tell a smoker, you can't smoke no matter what happens for the next 4 hours, and you cue them, you don't get the brain activation. So if you know it's going to be impossible, right, you're not going to, your brain's not going to be activated. But the best way to decrease the power of a stimulus, right, is which creates thoughts of wanting, is to come to the point where you really don't want it anymore. And how do you do that? The only way to do that, because you go, boy, you know, those chocolate chip cookies, that piece of cake, that's going to taste great, and it will, right? But you're going to have to want something more. So people, I mean, diets are not going to work. Let's make sure everyone understands that. Sure, that you can take somebody, you know, where the old neural circuitry has been laid down, this conditioned and driven behavior, the circuitry, the learning is laid down, and they could deprive themselves for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, they can lose the weight. But if they not lay down new learning, not lay down new circuitry, not change their relationship with food, they're going to go back into their food environment, going to get cued again and be bombarded with cues. And what do you think is going to happen? Of course they're going to gain back their weight. So the remember when we were kids, we used to play with these finger cuffs you put your fingers in, and the harder you pulled them, right, the more that your fingers got stuck. In some ways, the way you take the power out of a stimulus, if you look at something and say, I want that, right, you know, that's only going to increase the wanting more. You have to find something else that you want more than that, and then it'll take the power out of the stimulus.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. We have several callers. We'll get right back to them. Just want to introduce again our guest, Dr. David Kessler. He's former commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. He served in that position under Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. He's a pediatrician. He's been dean of the med schools at Yale and University of California, San Francisco. And he is the author of the book, The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. The Rodale Press is the publisher. Next up, we have a caller in Champaign, line 3.
Hello. Dr. Kessler, good to have you with us. I have two questions. How much do you cover basic nutrition in your book, and do you recommend any cookbooks or any separate books on nutrition? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Right.
So the book focuses on is why it's so hard to resist in the process. By which we become our behaviors become conditioned and driven, goes inside the food industry, shows how food is constructed, and then tries to give people plans for how to, you know, to change that. We joke, you know, how do you really change the behavior? You lay down new learning, and that's called food rehab. So that's what the book focuses on. It's not a basic book in nutrition. There are many good basic books in nutrition. You know, Marion Nestle, my colleague, really go into the nutritional aspect. You know, most people, I think, have a good sense of what's good for them and what's not good for them. It's not that people, no question it's hard. It's getting harder. Because especially we don't know what's in our food, especially restaurant food. The Washington Post outed me because I went dumpster diving for close to a year to try to find out what was in our food. So for many of us, we don't even know what's in our food. But we have a pretty good sense of what's good for us and what's not good for us. The problem is, how do we resist the stuff that we know we don't want to be eating? But there's some very good books. Mary Nessel is one, and I recommend her to you. You had another call.
Hmm. All right. Let's go to line number one next. This is Savoy. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I've had a weight problem all my life, but it's just the opposite. I can't hold on to weight. I was a thin child, and I've been a thin adult, and I've been struggling with my weight for the last 10 years. First, I was 114, then I went down to 110, and now I'm 105, and I feel I've accomplished something if I can put on a pound. Now, I'd have to feed my face 24 hours a day to gain 2 pounds, and then if I stop, I lose it. I eat ice cream and some cookies every day for a dessert just to try to keep some weight on. So my husband's just the opposite. He's been overweight since he was a child, and he eats very little, and he did lose weight and get down to 210, but I don't know how he maintains that weight. He's a big man, and he just doesn't eat that much. So I really think metabolism has a tremendous amount to do with this, and I've seen other examples of this besides myself and my husband. So I'm wondering, could it have maybe one thing, maybe some people's body systems are more reactive, so they burn up calories more quickly? Is that at all a possibility or a factor? And some are less reactive, so and more laid back, so they don't burn up calories like reactive people. But what I wish someone would write a book to help people like me, because you know it doesn't feel, you don't have a good body image either when you know you're too thin and you want to try to cover up. I'm not anorexic yet, but you know, it's not a comfortable position to be in for a person that tends to be too thin.
Sure, you know, it you really raised some very interesting points, and it is important. Let me ask just one question, and I don't mean to, you know, if I'm asking on the air, I shouldn't ask, you know, don't feel you have to answer it. But how important is food to you? How much do you care about food?
Well, I'm not one of those people that lives to eat. I eat to live.
Right.
But I do enjoy my food when I eat it, and I make a point of having a breakfast, a lunch, and a dinner. And my doctor suggested I snack in between my breakfast and my lunch and my lunch and my dinner, but I usually don't take time to do that. But it would have to be a very high-calorie snack, or it just would be like, you know, throwing water through a sieve. I just can't seem to. When I was a child, my dad used to put me on these special preparations, you know, packed with vitamins, trying to get weight on me. So I just think that maybe, and I was a thin baby, actually. So I don't know. It seems like it's something you're born with. I did get diagnosed a while back, a few years back, with Graves' disease, and they nuked that, and then I had to take, now I take supplements. But, you know, it hasn't affected my weight at all. I still have trouble being thin. I think I put on some weight, maybe, but I didn't.
So we're going to take you, and we're going to take David, and we're going to bottle you and figure out what the two of you, right? And we could support the NPR stations for the rest of our lives if we can figure out what it is about the two of you, right? The millions of us look at the two of you and say, hey, that, you know, that's not us. See, but you've confirmed, if when I listen to you and listen to you carefully, right, when I asked you how important food is, you like food like anyone else, right? You and I taste food probably the same.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference? The level of wanting, right? For to say, you know, food is just not that important. Sure, you like it, but it's not where you food has become so important where you have the real wanting. It's not where, you know, you're talking to me right now and you're thinking about what you're going to be eating next. So what the most salient food has not become for you a very salient stimuli. Right? It's a different. See, I don't think it's as much metabolism. I mean, there are set, you know, our brains are, you know, have certain, for each of us, it's sort of, you know, it settles at a different point. What I think the real difference is the degree of wanting. You don't want food as much as somebody who's, you know, 30, 40, 100 pounds bigger. Measure the level of wanting. Watch somebody. Go
but
into
I
a
do
restaurant
want
and watch
to
people
weight.
Eat.
I do want to gain weight.
I'm sorry.
I said, but I do want to gain weight, and I could eat, drink milkshakes all day, which I think are delicious, but I don't know that I'd really, even if I did that every day, I think I'd have trouble putting on weight, because that's the way it's always been. I'm just
but
one
you,
of those
But you don't
people.
Have the wanting. You don't have the real drive. It's not where food, you know, you want food and need food, right? You don't have the same motivation for food as other people. That's what's key. And it's not, understand,
but how
this
does
is not
that
a disease.
Affect holding on to weight or not?
Right, but understand, it's not a disease. This is people who have greater wanting, people who have less wanting of food. This is part of being human. We are each wired and each have different degrees, and we're captured by different salient stimuli. For many of us, we have greater levels of wanting. You happen to be on that, on the continuum, where your level of wanting, not your liking, but your wanting for food, is not as great as many other people.
I need to jump in here. I hope the call will forgive me. We just have a couple of minutes left. I have one more person I'd like to try to get. Let's do that. Champagne is the call, line number three. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
My addiction when I was younger was ice cream. And my comment used to be is hitting two ice cream parlors in the same day. But what about the – I only heard the last half. Did you talk about the impact of stress on eating?
Very important point.
Yeah, I mean,
stress increases the reward value of food. Right? So if you stress me, if you fatigue me, if you deprive me, you're going to increase the reward value of highly palatable food. It drives the circuitry. So there's greater attention on those foods that can capture and activate the brain. Because why? Because when your brain gets activated, there's a period of time where, I mean, that's what's occupying working memory. So when you're stressed, you eat to try to reduce the stress. You reduce, it's as if you're self-medicating. Stress is a major component that drives the reward circuitry and increases the reward value of food.
Okay, good.
All right. One thing that I want to ask you about here, there are people who have argued that one way to get at this is regulation, legislation. They've talked about things like trying to look at, for example, fast food restaurants, the food that they serve, and compel them to offer a more healthy product, or at the very least that there ought to be prominent labels there, information in the store about the content of the food that people are eating. Well, I wonder what you think about either or both of those kinds of things.
David, once we understand that our behavior is becoming conditioned and driven, we're laying down the neural circuitry, not only of us, but of our kids. That has profound implications from a policy perspective. Does the food industry have to change? Absolutely. Does government have a greater role? Yes. Greater disclosure, greater education, the implications for the school lunch program, what's in vending machines, what we subsidize with our tax dollars. Those are all key policy changes. Right? But in the end, what's very important is just because our brains are being activated as individuals, we need to take steps to protect ourselves, to fight back. It's not just a question of government regulation.
I wonder if it concerns you at all if some people will look at this kind of research and say, well, obviously, if what we got here is a brain chemistry problem, we know a few things about brain chemistry and altering brain chemistry, and maybe we can work on that, and maybe we can get to the point where we'll have a medication for this. We can give it to people, and we'll say, okay, here, you got a problem with overeating? Here, take this pill.
But understand the problem is not just with overeating. Mm. Right? Understand that the circuits we're talking about that are being affected are the circuits that make us human. They're the learning, motivational, memory, and habit circuits. They're not just for food. The reason why these drugs, you know, are not going to be selective for just food, they're always going to have certain adverse events, is because these are not diseases we're talking about. The effect of, you know, on these circuits, right, and this activation, that's part of what makes us human.
So that it's you're saying, and I know what you have said is that you fiddle with this brain chemistry at your peril, because there might be all sorts of unintended consequences.
I thought when I started to understand why it's so hard to resist these foods, I thought I'd go into the world of physiology and endocrinology and nutrition. I ended up inside the brain of what makes us human. We're wired to focus on the most salient stimuli, and the salient stimuli, again, it could be some for alcohol, some tobacco, some gambling, but for many of us it's food, and you're not going to be selective. You're not going to be able to knock out just those circuits without changing things that we need to function in our daily lives.
Hmm. Do you have some thought, or not just you, but people who have looked at this, about what's going on with those people, that small percentage of the population, who it seems like this kind of thing that you've talked about, it just doesn't work in them the same way.
But so food for them, that food is not a very highly salient stimuli.
Hmm.
Right now, the question is, do they just have, is there an underlying trait? You know, certain people are more, I mean, I go into restaurants and I watch couples, right, and I watch them eat. One of them will eat three-quarters of their sandwich. The other one will be reaching over and grabbing the fries from the other one's plate. Now, is there, you know, there's not a gene for overeating. It doesn't work that way. But there may be some underlying trait differences. And I don't know whether this is genetic or I don't know whether this is learned. Certain people are more, when there's stimuli, they're more outgoing. They'll reach it for it. They'll approach it. Others are a little more avoidant. So some are a little more introverted. Some are more extroverted. And I wonder whether that has something to do. Certain people respond, are more sensitive to reward stimuli. Others are more avoidant. And I wonder whether that's part of and can help us figure out why this small percentage of the population for whom food doesn't capture their neural circuits, why they react the way they do.
There we'll have to leave it, but if you want to read more on the subject, the book is The End of Overeating, Taking Control of the Insatiable American Appetite. That is the subtitle. It's published by Rodale by our guest, Dr. David Kessler. He is the former commissioner of the U.S. FDA. He's a pediatrician, served as the dean of the med schools at Yale and University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Kessler, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
This program comes from the Focus 580 archives. It was first broadcast on June 26th. Many past interviews from Focus 580, the afternoon magazine, a lot of our local production there, available for you to listen anytime you like. Just go to our website. It's Will, that's W-I-L-L, will.illinois.edu. Focus 580, this program is supported in part by Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Now with four area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center, north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information available at bodyworkassociates.com. We are broadcasting from Campbell Hall for public telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. That's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, a couple of guests will join us today. An artist, Angela Rivers, and an art and architectural historian, Sharon Irish. We'll talk about memory, history, community, and art. That's coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, December wheat, 528 and three quarters, up 3 3/4. March, 544 and a half, up 3 1/2. In Chicago, December wheat, 512 and a half, up 1 1/4. March, 531 and a half, up 1 1/4. December corn, 384 and three quarters, up 3. March, 396 and three quarters, up 3 1/2. May, 404 and three quarters, up 3 1/2. July, 411 and three quarters, up 3 1/2. November beans, 999 and a quarter, up 6 1/4. January, 1002, up 6 1/4. March, 1001 and a quarter, up 6. May, 994 and a quarter, up 4 3/4. July, 991 and three quarters, up 5 1/4. October meal, 337.20, up 10.90. October oil, 35.93, up 7. October live cattle, 82.92 and a half, up 72 and a half. December, 85.72 and a half, up 105. October feeder cattle, 93.80, up 75. November, 94.30, up 117 and a half. October lean hogs, 51.15, up 70. Outside markets, November crude, 74.86, up 71. The U.S. dollar, 75.58, that's down 40. The CRB index, 269.30.